ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
We also discuss why a plant-based diet is healthiest for humans and also the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, if you're concerned about your health, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas. Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Dr. Richard Schwartz of the Jewish Vegetarians of North America. That's a little later on the show, but first some news.
From The Slate, right now in a high-security research lab at Northwestern University's Falk Center for Molecular Therapeutics, scientists are tickling rats. Their goal? To develop a pharmaceutical-grade happiness pill. But their efforts might also produce some of the best evidence yet that humor isn't something experienced exclusively by human beings. Scientists believe human laughter evolved from the distinctive panting emitted by our great ape relatives during rough and tumble play. That panting functions as a signal that the play isn't all good fun and nobody's out to tear anybody else's throat out. In a clever bit of scientific detective work, psychologist Marina Davila Ross of the University of Portsmouth in the UK analyzed digital recordings of tickle-induced panting from chimps, bonobos, gorillas, and orangutans, as well as human laughter, and found the vocal similarities between the species match their evolutionary relationships. Chimps and bonobos, our closest relatives, boast the most laughter-like kind of panting, while the noises of gorillas, further down our family tree, sound less like laughing. And orangutans, our truly distant cousins, pant in a most primitive way. Non-human primates don't just laugh, there's evidence they can crack their own jokes. Coco, a gorilla in Woodside, California, who has learned more than 2,000 words and 1,000 American Sign Language signs, has been known to play with different meanings of the same word. When she was asked, "What can you think of that's hard?" the gorilla signed, "Rock" and "Work." She also once tied her trainer's shoelaces together and signed, "Chase." But what about other members of the animal kingdom? Do they have funny bones? Mark Beckoff, University of Colorado Boulder Professor of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology, and author of The Emotional Lives of Animals, believes they do. In fact, he thinks we're on the cusp of discovering that many animals have a sense of humor, maybe even all mammals. The idea that animals can appreciate comedy isn't as far-fetched as it sounds, considering some of the other groundbreaking discoveries scientists like Beckoff are making about animal behavior. They have found dogs that understand unfairness, spiders that display different temperaments, and bees that can be trained to be pessimistic. As Beckoff points out, Darwin argued that the difference between human and animal intelligence is a matter of degree, not of kind. Or as Beckoff put it, if we have a sense of humor, then non-human animals have a sense of humor too.
The Center for Biological Diversity reports that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's latest reports highlights the increasing threat from rising global meat and dairy consumption to limiting global warming, especially as the world population continues to grow. Stephanie Felstein, Population and Sustainability Director at the Center for Biological Diversity, says that the IPCC report shows that our appetite for meat is not only harming the environment, but is a threat to the livable climate for people and wildlife around the globe. She says that we need to drastically reduce the amount of meat in our diets if we hope to fight climate change and the extinction crisis. As the world population grows, so will diets high in meat, milk, and cheese, and subsequently climate pollution from food production. If agricultural emissions are left unchecked, nitrous oxide and methane from livestock could double by 2070 and make it nearly impossible to meet key goals for curbing climate change, according to the new study that was released by researchers at a Swedish university. The study says that beef and lamb account for the largest agricultural emissions relative to the energy they provide. By 2050, estimates indicate beef and lamb will account for half of all agricultural greenhouse gas emissions while only contributing 3% of human caloric intake. Cheese and other dairy products will account for about a quarter of the total agricultural climate pollution. The Center for Biological Diversity recently launched a new campaign urging Americans to take extinction off their plates. The campaign asked people to reduce their environmental footprint and help save wildlife by eating less meat. More than 14,000 people have already taken the center's pledge. If you'd like to do it, you can find information, including the Earth-Friendly Diet Pledge, at www.takeextinctionoffyourplate.com.
You know the old saying, an apple a day keeps the doctor away? Well, it turns out that eating one apple isn't enough. A new study suggests people who eat up to 7 servings of fruit and vegetables a day can cut their risk of death by 42%, and that vegetables may be more important than fruit to your overall health. The study, conducted by scientists in the United Kingdom, was published last month in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health. Researchers looked at data from more than 65,000 adults over age 35 who participated in the study between 2001 and 2008. Portion sizes were defined by the UK's Department of Health to be about 80 grams or just under 3 ounces. The new study authors compared nutrition information to mortality data for the group over the following 8 years. The participants ate an average of 3.8 servings of fruit and vegetables per day. Older, non-smoking women tended to eat more than other demographic groups. Produce consumption was also linked to participants' body mass indices. Those who ate more fruit and vegetables tended to have lower BMI. The researchers found that a diet rich in fruits and vegetables can be protective against cancer, heart disease, and all other causes of death. Eating at least 7 servings was best, but each serving increase was associated with a lower risk of death. Researchers found that people who ate at least 7 daily servings of fruit and vegetables had a 42% lower risk of death from all causes than those who ate less than 1 daily serving. When researchers broke it down by cause of death, the veggie eaters had a 25% lower risk of dying from cancer and a 31% lower risk of dying from heart disease or stroke. Vegetables seem to provide a greater health benefit than fruit. Eating more than 3 or 4 servings of fruit daily didn't increase a study participant's chance of survival. So eat more vegetables. Even if you think you have a healthy diet now, you can always improve it. Stay with us. Coming up next, we feature a conversation with Dr. Richard Swartz, President Emeritus of the Jewish Vegetarians of North America. That's next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on ACT Radio, Richard Swartz. Thanks for being with us, Richard. It's been a while.
Yes, it has, but it's always a pleasure to be on your program, and I really commend you for the wonderful work you're doing promoting vegetarianism, animal rights, and all the good causes.
Thanks, Richard. Could you tell our listeners again about how you became involved in veganism and vegetarianism?
Okay, actually it started, I was teaching mathematics at a college in Staten Island, and one of the courses was for liberal arts non-science students. You know, I was poorly motivated, but I had to take one math course for graduation. And I came up with this idea, and I created a new course that really expanded later, called Mathematics in the Environment. And the idea was to, again, try to motivate them by relating math to environmental issues and later nutritional issues. Anyway, 1 year, we focused on world hunger, and at the beginning I thought, it's really a shame, 20 million people are dying of hunger, there's just too many people, not enough food. Then I read this wonderful book by Frances Morlapay, Diet for a Small Planet, and she pointed out the tremendous wastefulness. Incredibly, that 70% of the grain produced in this country is being fed to animals destined for slaughter. Making it even worse, of course, is taking healthy foods like soy and oats and corn, feeding it to animals, and losing all the fiber and complex carbohydrates and having a product with cholesterol, saturated fat, very unhealthy. Anyway, so it really started in terms of hunger, but then as I got into it more and found out about the health and environmental and, of course, terribly animals are treated, I got into it more and more, and ended up writing this book, Judaism and Vegetarianism, and been working on this. That first edition, by the way, came out in 1982. So I've really been involved, starting before that for like 35 years.
And how long were you president of the Jewish Vegetarians of North America?
Okay, actually, president for about 10 years, and just recently, some very good things are happening. We have a new executive director, so I've become like a president emeritus. And as a matter of fact, they're having an event on May 19th, celebrating my 80th birthday, trying to raise some funds for the group and trying to promote that. So I've been really involved many, many years. And luckily, Judaism has very powerful teaching. There's other religions, too. You know, they're all based on compassion and sharing and improving things for the poor and the hungry, etc. So many people do it from a secular point of view, but I'm doing it and saying if anybody, Jewish religious values and religious values in general, seriously, they should definitely be a vegetarian and even more so a vegan.
The religious aspect of vegetarianism isn't often touched on. People look at animal abuse and health issues and the environment, but there are strong religious arguments for being vegetarian as well.
Oh, absolutely. A lot of people go wrong, I think, because they look at the first chapter of Genesis and they see that people are given dominion, but the sages really interpret that as responsible stewardship. You know, that it's just like hiring a gardener to take care of a garden if you don't have the time or the ability to do it. And really, you're giving that gardener dominion over your garden, but of course, that's to be done in a positive way. And also, I think you're 100% right in saying that there are powerful religious reasons. So I try to emphasize six of them, six mandates that point to vegetarianism and even more veganism as the ideal diet from a religious perspective and also from a universal perspective. So these are six mandates: to take care of our health, to treat animals with compassion, to be co-workers with God in preserving the environment, conserve natural resources, help hungry people, and also to seek and pursue peace. And all of these very powerful religious arguments, and I'm trying to spread them and to very respectfully even challenge rabbis and others to a debate. And should Jews be vegetarians? Should religious people in general? Should everybody be? And to me, it's becoming more and more not just an individual, important individual choice, but it's a societal imperative.
Yeah.
You know, if we are to have a chance to avert a climate catastrophe, serious food scarcities, water scarcities, all these things we're seeing more and more, and most people are not aware the fact that, whereas, for example, there's 7 billion people, a little more than 7 billion in the world today, but 60 or 70 billion farmed animals, and the tremendous contribution to climate change and other environmental problems related to that.
Yes. Drought. So many places are running out of water. And I've read that, you know, future wars will be fought over water. Animal agriculture is just so resource intensive that we can't afford to do it anymore.
Absolutely. The droughts are, aquifers are running out, and of course climate change is causing the glaciers to be melting. So that is a major factor. And actually, one fact, though, unfortunately there's so much denial out there, but one of the things is the military experts are now seeing climate change, which animal-based agriculture contributes quite a bit to. Some indicate it's one of the major contributors. But climate change, according to these military experts, is like a multiplier effect for terrorism, violence, and war. Because unfortunately, we've seen that already. There's going to be millions and millions of fleeing refugees from droughts, flood storms, wildfires, you know, other effects of climate change.
I mean, I think you've really hit the nail on the head that, you know, some people use their faith to relegate any issues involving animals to, you know, just a mere afterthought, instead focusing in their eyes only on human issues, where, you know, when you talk about climate change, if you care about humans, you really should care about these issues.
Oh, absolutely, because you know, the fate of humanity is involved in all this. You know, it's, as I say, not just an individual choice. And that's a message that we have to get out there. What I've been saying recently is almost that animal-based diets and agriculture, if you really want to call it what it is, it's madness and sheer insanity. When you realize how it's contributing to an epidemic of disease, to widespread hunger, to climate change, water shortages, I mean, it's destroying our forests, the coral reefs, every environmental problem is seriously affected by animal-based agriculture. So I'm saying it's really madness and sheer insanity, especially because, as you well know, it's not like a deprivation. There's so many wonderful, delicious vegetarian, vegan dishes more and more in the supermarkets, more and more restaurants opening up. So what I'm saying is we have to combat that madness and sheer insanity with what some are calling almost the moral passion of the biblical prophets, to really challenge the establishment to go out, and I hope every listener consider this, to go to their minister, priest, imam, rabbi, and say, you know, God's world is so threatened today. Why don't we have this on our agenda? You know, I'm not asking you to necessarily be a vegetarian, but at least let's discuss it, and let's see that if we really care about God's earth, and there's so much, you know, like the Book of Psalms says, for example, that God's compassion's over all his works, including, of course, animals. The Book of Proverbs says that the righteous individual considers the lives of his or her animals. So, I mean, there's so many powerful teachings. So how can we ignore the tremendously negative effects on health, on the environment, on animals, on the world-hungry people, on the very inefficient use of resources, so wasteful of water and land and energy? So we've got to get these issues onto religious agendas and every agenda.
You've been doing this for a long time now, and it seems like there's been an increase in recent years of vegetarianism and veganism in the United States anyway. But do you think it's too late, or can we still turn things around?
Well, we've got to be optimistic. Unfortunately, there are many scientists that say we could be very close, if we haven't passed already, a tipping point with regard to climate change. For the first time in human history, we've passed 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, where the experts feel that 350 is like a threshold. So we've got to get back to that, but unfortunately it's increasing. But we've got to make it a societal imperative. We've got to make it a focal point, you know, starting in the schools and churches, synagogues, mosques, etc. So we've got to do everything possible. But unfortunately, we heard this expression that denial is not just a river in Egypt.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the vast majority of people, from what I see, are in effect rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic while we head toward that giant iceberg. So somehow we've got to waken people up, and that's why I'm so glad to be on your program and all the great things you're doing week in and week out to get this message out. And it's just, we've got to get it out to our religious leaders, our politicians, educators, to get the media involved. And because, for example, over 99% of the refereed articles in science journals all indicate, you know, the ones that are discussing climate change, that human activities are causing climate change and it's a great threat to humanity. But unfortunately, the media may be trying to be balanced and showing both sides is not really indicating really how serious the threats are.
Yeah, and you know, I guess going back to your point of going to your church or your, you know, wherever you practice your spirituality, I know the challenge for a lot of people is just being able to start that conversation. You know, for instance, I get the emails from the Christian Vegetarian Association, and I can't tell you how many emails, you know, that are exchanged on that about just how do you open the door for a conversation. And you know, what's your advice, you know, if someone's trying to approach their rabbi or their pastor or priest, what's the best way to help get the message out?
Okay. Well, first of all, I have one article just on that. I've been trying to get this dialogue going, and for the most part, there's denial out there, as I said. So I have an article at my website, jewishveg.com, which is the website of the Jewish Vegetarians in North America. But if you add a slash and then S-C-H-W-A-R-T-Z, I have over 200 articles there, and one of them is a made-up dialogue between a Jewish vegetarian activist and a rabbi. So I think in terms of doing that is just, of course, always be respectful and going to minister, priest, rabbi, imam, etc., and just saying, you know, I've been reading about the droughts in California, the flooding here, the wildfires. I think something's going on out there. And I understand that animal-based agriculture is a factor. Can we get the issue of vegetarianism onto the agenda? And again, it's not like we're starting a new religion. Again, it's just pointing out, for example, that the first dietary law in Genesis chapter 1, verse 29, strictly vegan, according to Isaiah, the peaceable kingdom to come will be vegetarian, you know, with the wolf dwelling with the lamb, the lion eating straw with the ox. No one shall hurt nor destroy all of God's holy mountain. And again, so there's much on that. And of course, a lot of evidence that we were created for a vegan diet, you know, in terms of our hands, our teeth, our stomach acids, a very long intestinal system compared to that of carnivorous animals. So I think just going and say, can we have a dialogue on this? And perhaps a religious leader will give a talk on it, because every religion has strong teachings about compassion for animals. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, it's part of the Ten Commandments, where it indicates that not only are human beings to rest on the Sabbath day, but animals are as well.
Also, it seems to me that every religion in the world seems to have some version of the golden rule.
Sure, sure. Yeah, do unto others. And every religion has something about helping the poor, the hungry, because these are factors that people don't take into account. I mean, the fact that in a world that's starving, 70% of the grain in the U.S. being fed to animals destined for slaughter, in a world that's getting thirstier and thirstier, with water shortages, the fact that an animal-based diet per person can require 14 times as much water as that for a person on a vegan diet. So very wasteful, very, very inefficient use of large resources.
Yeah, it's definitely a human rights issue. And I think, you know, certain religious establishments have been criticized for not focusing on that. But, you know, even in the U.S. alone, what do they say, one in four people go to bed hungry at night, and it's happening right here.
Oh, absolutely. As I say, so it's such a wasteful thing to feed it to the animals, and in the process coming up with a product that is far less healthy. So, as I say, madness and sheer insanity.
This reminds me of a point you touched on earlier, that it's not an individual choice anymore. When somebody chooses to eat meat, I often hear, well, you're welcome to eat plants, but don't tell me what to eat. We have an obligation to stop them from eating meat, because it's destroying the world.
Absolutely. Well, at least to make them aware of what the situation is. If they care about it, having a decent world for children, grandchildren, future generations, they have to take this into account. And we have to realize where we're heading in terms of climate change, in terms of food and water and energy shortages in the future. So, we do have a free society. Can't force people to do things, but at least they should be aware of it. And we need our leaders really to point out where we're heading and why it's essential that major changes be made very, very soon.
And I thought it was fascinating that you brought up, you know, what the military experts are saying about climate change. It's not something I've thought a lot about. And I think, you know, for many of our listeners, they have someone in their family in the military if they're not in it themselves. And I think of, you know, my family in particular. And God, you just hate to see that something as simple as, you know, what you eat for lunch is going to eventually affect, you know, people's lives in a war zone. It's just insane.
Yeah. By the way, sort of related to that, the Jewish sages saw that the Hebrew word for bread, which is lechem, and war, milchama, come from the same root, and they deduced from that when there's a shortage of grain and other resources, people are more likely to go to war. So from that, I've come up with this idea that the slogan of the vegetarian movement and the slogan of the peace movement should be one and the same. All we're saying is give peas a chance. So people have to see that everything is connected to everything else, and among other things, if we want a more peaceful world, without a step toward vegetarianism. That's, I think, just in summarizing, it's really essential there be a shift toward vegetarianism, toward vegan diets, to have a better world in the future. Well, if people want to contact me, I have an email address, president@jewishveg.com, and I have 200 articles at jewishveg.com/warts, and be happy to work with anybody on these issues, because this has to become really a major, major priority for our future.
And give us the website again where your articles can be found.
Okay, of course, www. It's one word, Jewish, followed by VEG. Of course, the first three letters in vegetarian or vegan. JewishBeg.com, and then a slash, and then my last name, S-H-W-A-R-T-Z.
Happy early 80th birthday.
And many more.
Thank you, thank you, and many more years for you, and continued success with your wonderful radio program.
Thanks. We've been talking with Richard Swartz, President Emeritus of the Jewish Vegetarians of North America. Thanks for being with us on the show, Richard.
Oh, my pleasure.
The Vegetarian Society of El Paso will be hosting a restaurant hopper at Opus World Bistro. That will be Friday, April 18th. If you'd like to go, you need to reserve, so call 342-7630 or you can email vsep.reserve@gmail.com.
Or you can visit our website at vsep.org, and you will also learn about the May 10th dinner while you're there. Make your reservations online if you wish. Our featured speaker will be Nick Cooney of Mercy for Animals. That's May 10th, and it'll be at the Sutherland Park Holiday Inn.
Approximately one in every six adults, or 17% of the U.S. adult population, has high blood cholesterol. And chicken eggs are known to be high in cholesterol. This Easter, do your heart a favor, skip the eggs, and go for a walk instead. If you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACK Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the Listen button. I'm Tom Linney.
I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Liz Walsh. For the Earth, the Animals, and a Healthier Humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.
I like spinach. I like kale. I like turnip greens, too. I like string beans and collard greens. And Brussels sprouts will do. That cabbage, oh, she's a cutie. Peas roll around and have such fun. Lettuce has pretty ruffles, but they're not number one. Give me some broccoli. Give it to me, please. Give me some broccoli. That's a word I That's what I said with that cute little bushy.